Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tim Heng, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Frying Pan River. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tim Heng about fly fishing the Frying Pan River. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout and the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Tim, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. We're again giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, you can go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Tim's section there that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and then we'll announce the winners of those drawings at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away 1 dozen hot flies for, guess what, the Frying Pan River in a nice Taylor Creek fly box, courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop in Colorado. And these are the perfect flies you'll need for the Frying Pan. You can learn more about Taylor Creek Fly Shop by visiting www.taylorcreek.com. Now, here's how you can win those. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Tim and I have talked about tonight, and you must be the first one to submit the correct answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, and we'll give you that question at the end of the show and see who wins. Our guest tonight is Tim Heng. Tim is a Colorado native and has been involved in the fly fishing industry in the Roaring Fork Valley for almost 30 years. Tim established the first fly fishing shop in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and helped pioneer drift boat fly fishing on the Roaring Fork River in the early 1980s. Tim joined the Taylor Creek Fly Shop in 1990, the oldest fly shop in the Roaring Fork Valley, with the most experienced guide staff. He also sponsored many fly fishing trips to Christmas Island, Ascension Bay, Mexico, Patagonia, Argentina, Los Roques, Venezuela, and Andros Island in the Bahamas. Tim enjoys tying flies and is an Umpqua contract fly designer and the creator of the Autumn Splendor and the BLM, and that's acronym for Beaded Little Mayfly. The BLM was awarded the Fly of the Year in 2002 by Fly Fisherman magazine. Tim has appeared on ESPN and ESPN2 and continues to write and speak at many of the fly fishing shows. Tim, thanks for joining us, and welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, did you have a good year up there in the Roaring Fork Valley fishing?
Had a terrific year. Actually, it started a little bit late because we had a very high snowpack last winter, but once it started, our fishing has been pretty outstanding since.
I did get a question here on the Internet. Do you know a person by the name of Paul Broom?
I do.
Okay. He wants to know how the runoff affected the fish health this year and how the flow should be expected for the rest of the year. And do you want to go fishing next week?
I always want to go fishing.
Well, there's a little surprise question came in at the last
That's a tough question to answer. But, no, certainly the high flows, I think, that we had early on that kind of kept us from fishing early on the Roaring Fork, as far as the float fishing goes, certainly made it a little bit more difficult. But I think that also all that cold water that we've had since and the amount of water that we've had since has made for some pretty outstanding fishing. And that's probably more on the Roaring Fork than the Frying Pan.
Yeah, it's more affected by the runoff.
Exactly. It being a free water or a freestone fishery versus the Frying Pan, which is a tailwater.
Well, we're going to talk about the Frying Pan River itself tonight and kind of get the lay of the land up there. It is a world-class fishery, very well known. So first of all, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty too with Tim here. He's going to share with us his strategies and techniques, tactics that he uses to fish a quite diverse fishery there. Tim, tell us first of all, why is this such a well-regarded fishery and where in the world is the Frying Pan River?
Well, first of all, the Frying Pan River is a tributary to the Roaring Fork River. They join here in the town of Basalt, which is about 15 miles from Aspen, and about 25 miles from Glenwood Springs, and probably about, from Denver, we're probably about 185 miles. Probably the reason why it is such a premier fishery is the fact that Rudi Reservoir, which is the reservoir that feeds the lower Frying Pan River, is a very deep reservoir, and so therefore we have a consistent water temperature of around 40 degrees year-round. And that consistent water temperature is what also contributes to such great mayfly hatches that we have and great population of insects that we have on the river below the dam.
One thing Brian Whiting in Glenwood Springs, just down the road for you. In fact, Brian was a guest on our show in the past as well, and he says it's a great year-round fishery. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because that always makes it more interesting if you can fish every month of the year.
And we're very fortunate in the fact that we can fish every month of the year, and we joke and we figure that we probably lose maybe 8 to 10 days a year on the Frying Pan that it's just so cold that you just don't want to be out there. The fish don't mind. I mean, they're in that water temperature year round, so they don't mind. They'll eat at any time of the year and do eat. It's just that the fishermen, it just is so cold that the fisherman doesn't want to get out there. But that's really, like I said, it's only maybe 8 or 10 days of the year. Oftentimes in the wintertime, our temperatures, are in the 20s and 30s and sometimes even low 40s. And you think that's awfully cold to be out there fishing, but if you dress appropriately and the fish mostly at that time of the year in the wintertime, we're fishing middle of the day. We're not fishing from sun up to sundown, but we're fishing that warmest part of the day from, say, 10 to 2 or something like that. And it's quite comfortable, and we generally have midge hatches that go on pretty much every day of the year, and you can catch fish on dry flies oftentimes in the middle of the winter.
So you can sleep in, have a nice big breakfast, go fishing, and still make happy hour by 4 o'clock, and you've got the best part of the day fishing, right?
That's right. You know, I mean, and there's a fair number of the folks that, you know, choose to go up, catch a half a day up on the ski slopes of the world-famous ski slopes of Snowmass and Aspen, and then choose to come down at around noon and get in a few hours of fishing. Doesn't get much better than that.
No, it sure doesn't. It sure doesn't. Well, I know I was up there one time. In fact, I was going to a wedding in Aspen, and it was late September, and the aspen trees were turning, and I forget what kind of bushes are up there, but they turn red up there on the slopes. But the Frying Pan Valley there was so beautiful in the fall, and that's always a gorgeous time to fish up there.
Yeah, every season has its beauty up there. There's no question about it, and every season has its different bug hatches, and it's constantly changing, and it's always an interesting fishery. There's no question about that.
Well, we got a question here, or a comment, basically, by Derek Andrews in Elkins, West Virginia. He says, you find it ironic that that you release most, if not all, the fish you catch on a river called the frying pan. And so that is kind of funny. But where did it get its name?
Well, Roger, I mean, it definitely has many different ideas of where it came up with its name. But probably the most popular is the fact that this area around here was very famous for its mining early in the late 1800s. And Aspen actually, in those times, actually had more people than it does now because of the mining that goes on, that went on during that time. And history has it that, or lore has it that a couple of miners were up on the upper parts of the frying pan and got attacked by some Indians. And one of the miners was injured very badly, and his friend decided to put him in a cave to go find help, to go find a doctor to help him out. And there were so many caves in the area up there that he hung a frying pan out in front of the one cave so that he wouldn't remember where he left his friend. And so that's kind of one of the many different stories of how the frying pan got its name.
Well, that's a pretty good one, though. We can go with that one, I think. Yeah. All right. Well, there had to be a reason somewhere down the road. Mike McEwen in South Africa, he's a long ways away, so he's wondering, what's it like there? What's the valley? What's the scenery look like? How big is the river? You know, do you drift or wade it?
Well, it strictly is a wade fishing river. It's too small to drift. The average cubic feet a second, which is probably one of the easiest ways to tell you how big the river is it probably averages about 150 cubic feet a second. Its width is 60 probably 60 to 80 feet for most of it. It can be easily crossed in most times of the year, back and forth. It sits in a valley of aspen and pines, really. Those are the two trees that are most prevalent. And coming out of Rudai Reservoir, it's at about 7,600 feet where the dam is, and it drops about 1,000 feet in the 14 miles to the town of Basalt here, where we sit at about 6,600 feet.
We had another question from Silas Gray in southwest Missouri. He wanted to know about using a kayak, so it's even tough to use a kayak in that river.
It's pretty tough to use a kayak. At certain times of the year, certainly the very lower parts of the river, some very experienced kayakers will be on it, but very seldom do we even see that. It's in the lower parts of the river, it falls the most, and so it's pretty technical.
Yeah, and you'd be spending most of your time with your hands on the paddle, I think, because it's got a pretty good, like you say, good drop. So it'd be tough to get any fishing in while you're trying to maneuver the river. It's not a mild-mannered kind of spring creek or something like that you can play around in. So,
no, yeah. It's not. It certainly is not. I mean, and the nice thing about the river is that the road parallels it for the entire 14 miles between Basalt and the dam, and so you can easily access it in the many different public access stretches to where a kayak doesn't really benefit you at all.
That brings up the question of how much is there of private water? Is that something you need to be aware of there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's okay. Of the 14 miles of water between here and the dam, about half of it is private and half of it is public. The private water is very well marked where the folks don't want you to be on it. There's signs and things like that. There's a terrific map put out by Mike Shook that shows all of the public access points on the entire river, as it does on the Roaring Fork River. But it's because it parallels the river, the road parallels it the entire length. It's pretty easy to tell where you should be and where you shouldn't be.
For people from out of state, maybe from out east or the Midwest, or even out of the country, how do the laws govern that? In that, let's say you're wading upstream and you're not paying attention, you wade into private land. Are you allowed to be fishing there, or is that trespassing?
That's trespassing. In the state of Colorado, the landowner owns the bottom of the river. Okay. And so if you're wading up the trout stream and you come to a no trespassing sign, you need to get out, go around this person's property, and get back in above it or whatever to where it's public water again. But that's the way the law is in the state of Colorado.
Right. And for those people from out of state or out of the country, that can change from state to state. So you have to kind of be aware of that when you're fishing a new area.
Exactly.
What kind of fish are we looking at that live in the frying pan?
You know, it's primarily brown trout and rainbow trout, with the brown trout probably being 70% right now anyway, and the rainbows being maybe 30%. There's a few cutthroats, there's a few brook trout, but primarily it's a brown trout and rainbow trout fishery.
Okay. Any other fish that you, whitefish, anything like that in there?
Very few. There, in the very lower stretches of the frying pan, there's a few whitefish, but very few. I mean, it's certainly, I think the water temperature has something to do with the fact that we don't see, and we certainly see a lot more whitefish down in the bigger river, the Roaring Fork, and I think it probably has something to do with water temperature that we don't see as many in the frying pan.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break here, and when we return, we'll talk with Tim more about fly fishing the frying pan river. Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Heng about fly fishing the frying pan river. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we've got a question which we'll answer here a little bit later from Jacob in Littleton. He wanted to know, you know, first-time visitor, which stretch of the public water would you recommend to them? So I think we'll cover that later on when we kind of do our walk up the river, don't you think, Tim?
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah, so we'll cover that a little bit later. Okay, so we've got some questions coming in. Good, good. Thank you, everyone, for putting those questions in. And I mix these in when the appropriate time comes, so we'll try to get to everybody's questions as we go through here. If you're coming up in that area, Tim, I know there's plenty of places to stay and so forth in the surrounding towns, such as Basalt and Cape Carbondale and even Glenwood Springs, I suppose. But Silas Gray from Missouri again wants to know, is there any good camping around there? Could he use a tent or a small trailer, depending on the time of the year?
Yes, there is. Actually, camping is illegal right along the river. You can't camp within a quarter of a mile of the river. But once you get up to the lake, on the closest end to the river, below the dam, there are three very nice campgrounds that sit on the lake overlooking Rudai Reservoir. And then as you get more up into the National Forest above the lake, there's several campgrounds up there, too. So there's a lot of areas that you can camp, either pulling a trailer or a tent camper, that are very well marked and are nice, very nice campgrounds.
And there's quite a bit of fishing around that area, too, if a person was coming for an extended time. You want to talk just briefly about the other fisheries in the area?
Absolutely, Roger. I mean, you know, certainly the Roaring Fork is the tributary to the frying pan, which is a tributary to the Roaring Fork, as we fish it for probably, 50 or more miles of it. It starts up on Independence Pass, runs down through the town of Aspen, down to Glenwood Springs, and offers many different types of fishery, from a very small stream fishery in its upper reaches to a larger river down below that we fish a lot out of drift boats. And it's a tremendous fishery as well. It's a freestone fishery, no dams on it, and has great hatches of the different mayflies that we'll talk about a little bit later on the frying pan as well. The Crystal River, which is runs through the town of Carbondale, which is also a tributary to the Roaring Fork, we fish quite often. And then the Roaring Fork is a tributary to the biggest river in our area, the Colorado River, and we also fish it for 35 miles around this area. So those are just the major rivers that we talk about, not including any of the small streams that are literally all over the high country up here, as well as many high country lakes. So you could fish here for, well, gosh, I mean, I've been fishing here for 35 years, and I've certainly never fished all of them. So
yeah, you're still not done, huh?
I'm still not done. I'm still working on it, and hopefully one day I'll get to all of them, but that's part of the fun of it is trying to fish them all.
And Rudi Reservoir itself is a pretty decent fishery, is it not, as far as the lake fishery?
It's pretty good. It certainly is not as much of a destination fishery as our rivers are. Our rivers really are what shine in our area here. But the reservoir is probably, because of the reason that it's so deep, it doesn't offer a lot of real shallow shorelines and things like that produce good aquatic hatches or, you know, real great growth of trout. There's lake trout in the lake, there's brown trout, and the state stocks rainbow trout. So it can be a great fishery. It's a great family area. There are people that ski on it and fish it quite a bit up by the campgrounds and things like that. But I would say that it's not as great of a fishery as our rivers are.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about, just real quickly, what size and weight rod would you normally use in the area there?
Well, you know, most of the rods we use are in the 8 to 9 feet range, probably 8.5, 9 feet being a little bit more popular. The rod sizes that we use as far as line sizes goes are mostly 3 to 5 weights. We use, oftentimes are using very light tippets. So, you know, it's a fairly heavily fished river. Some people will think that that's an understatement because it does get a lot of fishermen on it at certain times of the year. And the fish can be very selective, and so we use a lot of tiny bugs, very light tippets. I like to use myself softer action rods rather than real fast action rods because the softer action rods seem to protect the light tippets that we have to use better. So, like I said, 3 to 5 weight rods with those light tippets and soft action, you'll catch a lot more fish.
And what about line? So are you using primarily floating lines then?
Floating lines, yeah. We use, we may use, if we're fishing streamers, some sink tips occasionally. But for the most part, we're using floating lines. If we're nymphing, we're using, putting lead on the leader or non-lead, if you choose, on the leader, strike indicators and that type of a thing. That seems to be most effective. Because oftentimes during the day, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be spending a portion of your day nymphing before the hatches get started. And then once the hatches get started, you're going to switch over to throwing dry flies. And so with a floating line, you're able to do it all much easier and much quicker.
What about, then can you talk specifically about your terminal tackle? Since it sounds like that's something that's critical. What's your normal setup?
Well, our normal setup is we're using a 7.5 to 9 foot leader. If we're using nymphs, oftentimes we'll attach 2 nymphs. Generally, you know, depending upon the time of the year, and we'll talk about the hatches a little bit later.
We got a question in online here, Tim, and might as well talk about this now since you just mentioned it. This is Lauren Kingsley in Dexter, Michigan. He says he was just out there last week. Had a tough time getting into public access water because of all the, you know, the fishermen competition for that water. Do you want to address that? Maybe talk about, you know, maybe other times of years that are less crowded or that kind of thing, or how you handle that, or when you're out there.
Sure. I mean, certainly us, you know, on the Frying Pan River, as well as most major tailwater fisheries in the West, you know, are. At the very popular times of the year when the most insects are hatching and also when the most folks are being able to fish is the summertime, you know, from the time that school is out until the time that school goes back in. Those are certainly the busiest times of the year. And certainly there's stretches of the river that are also the most busy. So you can generally always pass by some of the water in the lower stretches of the frying pan where you don't see as many fishermen, and you can fish those waters, still have good numbers of fish, perhaps not as many fish as it does right up close to the dam. But it can get very crowded at certain times of the year. That's it's kind of the unfortunate part of the popularity of our sport.
Yeah, yeah, and limited water.
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, we say limited water, but we still have, you know, 7 miles of river that is open to the public, and certainly the first 2 miles below the dam is probably the most popular, has the biggest fish, in the summertime it has some of the best hatches and things like that, and that's what people will congregate toward, and often, like I said, they'll pass up some water down below where it's still public water, maybe not as great as fishing, but still pretty good fishing, and to go up there and fish that more crowded water.
Yeah. And of course, most of the western rivers out here too will lighten up significantly after Labor Day. So,
they already have, Roger. We're already seeing less folks this week already since the Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. So as far as that goes, you know, I guess the suggestion for people out of state is, boy, if you come in prime season, July and August, you're going to get the crowd. So try to get off of that a bit. And you know, great spring fishing and great fall fishing when a lot of folks aren't out there pounding it. So
some of my favorite times of the year, quite frankly, are March and April, September, October, and even into November.
Yeah.
Kind of the shoulder seasons still can have some terrific hatches, but a lot less folks.
Yeah. I kind of interrupted you when you were talking about terminal tackle and the setup there because of the because it is fished heavily and these fish are smart. So you want to go back into that a bit, Tim?
Sure. You know, again, it kind of depends a little bit on what hatches we're going after and what time of the year you're fishing out here. But oftentimes we'll use to our nymphs if we're nymphing, which we'll do when we're not seeing many fish rise. It's not a river that lends itself to fishing a tractor dry flies very well because it's such a insect-rich river. You have to be a little bit more, the fish are a little bit more selective than they are opportunistic. So when we're nymphing, we'll oftentimes use 6X to our top fly and 7X to our bottom fly in a nymph rig. Our weight will be oftentimes maybe 8 or 10 inches above your top fly. And the strike indicator may be 6 to 7 feet up from that. So that's kind of the nymphing rig. Dry fly fishing, you know, some folks use one or two dry flies as well. Usually when I'm fishing some of the really tiny flies that we oftentimes fish in the shoulder seasons, little blue wing olives or the midges or things like that, I'll fish with the dries, I'll fish a larger dry fly as my top fly, something that I can see better, and then trail it with a smaller fly that I have a lot more trouble seeing. And oftentimes if you can see where it lands out there, then you can find that other smaller fly next to the bigger dry fly that you're fishing.
So you don't always get to fish those, what, size 12 green drakes or whatever's that? They just huge to me. What size are those?
They're a legitimate 12. It's the largest mayfly that hatches in Colorado, and it's a size 12.
Yeah. Well, that can lead us into the question about hatches here, since you've segued into that rather nicely. If you could talk just a few minutes and kind of maybe just because it's like you said, just an insect rich area. I mean, they've got so many hatches. Maybe you can kind of walk us through the year and what hatches are available and what bugs we're looking for.
Sure. I mean, we can just start out from the beginning of the year. I mean, from January 1, basically, you know, we're seeing midges hatching, and we're seeing generally in the middle of the winter, we're seeing the smaller midges in the ranges of 20s to 24s. So we're fishing little midge larvae at that time of the year. If we're not seeing fish rise, and again, those are going anywhere from 20s to 24s and many different varieties. Reds, blacks, grays, zebra midges work well. And then around the 1st of March, we start to see some real large midges hatching. It's almost an 18, which is considered very big for a midge, and the fish get on those very heavily. And we'll see that go pretty much the whole month of March. We'll start to see our little blue wing olives start around late March, early April, and you'll have the blue wing olives. They'll be in the range of 18s to 20s, and they'll hatch best on overcast days. And the fish will eat them best on overcast days, although they'll eat them in the bright sun as well. We'll fish that on the frying pan up until even into June at times. And then we'll start to see some caddis popping off. And then pale morning duns will start generally around the middle of July, as will the drakes. And they'll start in the lower parts of the river first, work their way on up toward the dam. We're pretty fortunate in the fact that there's so many bugs. We'll still see PMDs and drakes hatching into early October. So they don't come off in huge, such huge numbers that they basically are all hatching within a two-week period of time like they are on some western rivers. So we're kind of fortunate in the fact that we have those long period of time for those bugs to be hatching. And then right during that same period of time with the PMDs hatching and the green drakes, we'll oftentimes see blue wing olives hatching right in the middle of the summertime. So years ago, we didn't see that very much. But in recent years, it seems like they'll be mixed in as well. And then as we get on into fall and October and November, we go back to the fall blue wing olives again. So we'll fish those. Again, you'll have rising fish on those almost every overcast day for sure, and even on some of the bright sunny days. And then we get back into the midges starting in December and fish those throughout the winter.
Did you mention it, or did I miss stoneflies? Is there any stoneflies on the river as well?
Well, we see some on the lower parts of the river, Roger. We'll see some of the bigger stoneflies, the golden stones, some of the Taranarses, the big dark stoneflies, but not huge numbers of them. We'll see some yellow sallies throughout the summer a little bit. Again, not huge numbers. Early in the year, we'll see some little early black stones and early brown stones that oftentimes people mistake for midges and can be imitated with most midge imitations. So we don't really differentiate those a whole lot, although there's quite a few of those. And that's, and I'm just kind of mentioning, when I mention these hatches, I'm kind of mentioning just the major hatches. There's any number of other hatches that go on, from mahogany duns to some little saratellas, which is just a real difficult bug to imitate. And there's a lot of other little micro hatches that go on as well, but those are what I mentioned are the major hatches that happen.
Okay. Well, we need to take a little break here. If folks out there that are listening live right now, if Tim sounded again garbled or kind of underwater over the last couple minutes, would you write in and let me know if he sounded clear to you or if he sounded like he was a little garbled, because I'm not sure if it's just me hearing it or other people as well. So if you'll let me know while I'm taking this break, I'd sure appreciate it. Just type in online, and we'll see if I just got one here. We're losing his audio again. Tim, can you dial in again?
You know what? I'll call you on my cell phone. We'll try that.
Let's try that. Okay. And meanwhile, we'll do a short break here. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. They provide year-round lodging for the business or pleasure travel, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit us at www.pmlodge.com or call, that's www.pm, as in Pere Marquette, lodge.com, pmlodge.com, or call 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tim Heng about fly fishing the frying pan river. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to enter your question, and we'll try to answer as many of your questions as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so lots of major hatches, lots of minor hatches to deal with. Sounds like you have to be well prepared with your fly box, huh?
Absolutely, you do. I mean, you know, there's everything from, like you said, the large size 12 green drakes. Our pale morning duns are about a size 16. Blue wing olives we're talking about in a size 18s to 22s. And then the midges in sizes 18s to 24s. So it helps to have a well-stocked fly box. I mean, that's what I always tell my wife anyway. That's why I need more flies.
That's why you're at the Vice or in the shop.
That's right.
Credit card, one or the other. Gary in Calgary, Alberta, wants to know if you have a favorite blue wing olive emerger pattern.
Oh, gosh. You know, I have several, and they vary from year to year. You know, I like little soft tackles an awful lot, little biot-bodied soft tackles, little Zelon winged like RS2 type of mergers. Seem to work very well as well, whether that be like I said, a Zelon wing or a little CDC wing. There's a lot of different ones that I'll fish at throughout the year.
Okay. Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas wants to know, is there a favorite fly combo for late summer and fall on the frying pan that you use? I guess when combo, he means, you know, kind of dry in a dropper or two dries or whatever.
Well, there is. I mean, I personally like to, during the fall time of the year, and we're talking when I'm, generally when I'm talking a little bit more into, probably a little more fall than late summer, but I like to fish the blue wing olives is probably my favorite hatch on these rivers just simply because it happens for such a long period of the time, and I like to fish, little droppers, little blue wing olive type nymphs behind a blue wing olive dry, either an emerger or a nymph behind a dry. And generally I like to, for a dry fish, a little parachute pattern, something that I can see fairly easily in a 18 or a 20, and I'll drop the nymph behind it anywhere from a foot and a half to 3 feet, depending upon the depth of the water I'm fishing.
Okay. I fail with all the audio problems to give you a chance to tell the folks about what you're doing out there in the fly fishing world nowadays. And I know you've kind of changed up things over the past few years, but why don't you just take a minute here, Tim, before we get into strategies and presentation here and working our way up the river, which we'll do right after, and tell the folks what you're up to in the fly fishing
world. Well, what I'm up to, I guess that I manage the Taylor Creek Fly Shop and have for many years, as you mentioned. I've kind of, I guess, semi-retired a little bit. I'm at the shop now for about three to three and a half months through the summer season, middle of June to the middle of September, and the rest of the year I'm kind of traveling the country, getting in a little bit more of my share of fishing that I felt like maybe I haven't quite had enough of for the last several years, although that's kind of hard to believe because I've done quite a bit of it.
You're not one of those guys that goes, like, down to the Caribbean during the winter and things like that, are you?
Well, I'll do a little bit of the Caribbean. I'll do a little bit of Mexico, you know, in the wintertime, just trying to fish some areas of the country that I haven't fished very much before, and fished a lot of Montana and Idaho and Wyoming and Colorado certainly and some of New Mexico, but there's a lot of parts of the country I haven't seen yet or haven't gotten to fish yet, and I'm looking forward to having an opportunity to fish those rivers more.
And you tie, I know you tie at the Denver Fly Fishing Show, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've been tying flies
for... speak down there and...
Mm-hmm. I have. I didn't do that last year, and I'm not sure I will this year because, again, I'm in the wintertime, I'm headed for some warmer climates.
So, okay. We'll understand, Tim. We'll understand.
Well, I hope so.
What's your what's the website address for Taylor Creek Fly Shop?
Taylor Creek, our website is www.taylorcreek.com, and there's a ton of information on there. We've got the couple of the guys here in the shop that do a great job of keeping that updated on a regular basis, and we urge the folks to check that out. Our phone number is on there. If they ever have any questions at all, feel free to give us a call. We'd love to, talk fishing. That's kind of what we do.
Okay, great, great. Well, thanks for sharing that. Okay, well, before we get into the strategies, we got a question here that came in online while we were talking, and Tyler, California, Arcata, California, I don't know how to pronounce it. I hear you talking about midges and drakes a lot, and what I want to know is how did the BLM pattern take shape? It reminds me of a red zebra midge with legs and a tail. Is that where it got started? You ought to know.
Well, I ought to know, yes. Actually, the BLM, which stands for a beaded little mayfly, for lack of another name, I couldn't come up with another name to save my life, but... it actually got started as a blue-wing olive nymph, more so than anything else. I started tying it, I started tying a version of it probably 15 years ago, and it used back then it used a crystal flash body, wing case, with a peacock-bodied, peacock thorax, kind of like a pheasant tail, very much like a pheasant tail, and certainly we were all influenced in our tying by other flies. I don't think there's any such thing as a brand new fly that somebody just thought up. It's always a version of another fly, and certainly mine was probably the pheasant tail that it was a version of. And then I started tying it, and instead of the peacock curl for the thorax, I started tying it with a little bead for the thorax, a bead to match the color of the body, for the most part, whether it be a copper bead or a black bead, and instead of using crystal flash, I found a material called angel hair, which was much finer, and so it essentially is like a flashy pheasant tail, and that's how that came about, and it came about because of the little blue-wing olive betis nymphs that I like to fish so much.
Now, is that do you have that recipe out on the internet anywhere?
You know, I think I certainly have it. It's been in a couple of books. Actually, Skip Morris has got a brand new book that's going to be out. I think if it's not out already, it's going to be out very soon, that has the recipe in it. But anybody certainly can, I can't recall if it's on our website or not. It may not be, but if they, have a question about it, they can certainly email us and, we'd be happy to send it to them.
There you go. There you go. Thanks. Let's work our way up the river here, Tim, because it is quite diverse fishery and changes quite a bit as it goes up the valley. So where do you want to start?
Well, let's start in the town of Basalt. Right at its confluence with the Roaring Fork River, there's some public water that is right through town, right behind our shop. Our shop sits right on the banks of the river we're probably not more than, our deck's not more than 10 feet away from it. But there's a short stretch of probably, maybe a little less than a half a mile of river that fishes quite well right through town here. And then once you get above town, there's some private property above that. And once you get above town, there's a canyon stretch that goes up for the next 3 or 4 miles. That's what we consider kind of the lower parts of the Frying Pan River, and that's where when we talked about the stoneflies, that's where we'll see most of the stoneflies. It's drops the most in that little stretch of 3 or 4 miles. The the river drops the most it does in its entire reach, or actually. Then once you get in that canyon water, is some of it is kind of difficult to get around in. Some of it kind of has steep banks leading down to the river. Certainly the younger you are, it seems like the easier it is for that stretch of river to be fished. But there's, you know, I still fish it quite a bit, and it offers some very nice fishing up until you get to an area called Seven Castles. And Seven Castles is about 4.5 miles up the river or so. Basically how it got its name was there's seven big red bluffs on the left as you're driving up. That's just gorgeous, and the valley kind of opens up there too as well. And
backing up a bit, I'm looking at a map in my hand here. There's a place called Kaufman Corner. Is that in the canyon area?
Kaufman Corner is in the canyon area. It is in that lower 4 miles of river, and okay. Certainly there's portions of the river that are very canyony, and then there's portions of it that are not as much. Kaufman Corner is an area. Strawberry Rock is another popular area. Just below
Seven Castles Creek is right after that. Then I think
just right after that. Yes.
Okay.
Seven Castles starts about 4.5 miles up the river.
Okay.
The Seven Castles stretch, and then there's a stretch right at Seven Castles there that we fish. It's very, very flat. The river is very difficult as far as it's more like a spring creek. It's very slow moving. And some very educated fish. It's oftentimes you'll see a lot of rising fish there, but boy, you've got to be on your game to catch those fish just because the water is so smooth in there.
Okay.
And then as
crystal
we move
clear,
up,
I take it.
Crystal clear, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the middle stretches of the river basically is what we call the middle stretches is from Seven Castles on up, probably to about the 9 mile marker. Again, interspersed with private and public property. It has more hatches, a little bit better hatches than it does on the lower parts of the river. More mayflies, certainly. More rising fish in the heat of the summer. And then we get onto the upper stretches of the river, which is the first 4 miles below the dam, and there's most of that is public except for a stretch of about 3/4 of a mile. That's the most heavily fished stretch of river that there is. The fish are the biggest there that they are in the entire river. Up close to the dam, we have Mysis shrimp, which, puts a tremendous amount of weight on those fish when they're being washed out from Rudai Reservoir, and also the very best hatches and the biggest concentration, the biggest numbers of fish per mile.
Okay, okay. Now I noticed a couple of creeks coming in, Taylor Creek, of course, Downey Creek, Wilson Creek. Do those affect the lower parts of the river as far as runoff or, you know, coloring of the river and so forth?
Usually not, and if they do, it's only for a short period of time. The only river that really, or the only creek that really does affect us is Seven Castles Creek, which comes out right at the bottom of Seven Castles area. It can sometimes, if there's a very large thunderstorm or something like that happens up there in the summertime, that can discolor the lower parts of the river. But usually those other little creeks, if they do, it's only for a very short period of time.
Okay. We did have a question from George Fant, and he said, I tried fishing the frying pan after a rain with no success. Can you make any suggestions for fishing the frying pan in rainy weather that we sometimes have in the fall?
You know, the only thing I would say is if George was trying to fish it after after the hatches or something like that were over with, late afternoon or evening. You know, oftentimes, in the fall anyway, most of our major hatches, and this can often be true in the summertime as well, most of the hatches are midday hatches. You don't have to get up real early in the morning to catch them, nor do you stay very late. The blue-wing olives will typically happen between anywhere from 11 o'clock in the morning till 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And then when that happens, those fish have been feeding very heavily during that period of time. They kind of shut off a little bit, and it's not necessarily because of a rainstorm or anything. It's probably more just because these fish have been eating so doggone much there while they've been there that it's just time for them not to eat anymore for a while.
Okay. Okay. What about, and I don't know, you may experience this more on the Roaring Fork, I don't know, but some people talk about, you know, got colored water, whatever, to about fishing the edges. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, sure. And, you know, in the edges we fish, you know, at different times for different reasons. You know, certainly colored water, sometimes the edges of a trout stream will be the clearest, whereas the main flow from the river is more discolored. And just because the edges are quieter water, it kind of silts out kind of some of that mud or debris in the water settles down to the bottom, so it's a little bit clearer. We also fish the edges when the rivers are higher, because that offers the most protection for the fish. So if there's, you know, and this summer's been on the Frying Pan has seen unusually higher flows simply because of the amount of snow that we had last year, snowpack that we had last winter. And so with the higher flows, those fish seek a little bit more protection along the sides of the stream than they would be. They don't want to be out fighting that heavy current any more than we want to be, you know, running a mile to get dinner every night.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the same analogy.
Yeah, exactly. One of the questions that did come in online, this is Kevin in Peachtree City. If faced with fishing the rapids, I guess he means this, you know, strong current. I don't know exactly what he means by rapids. How do you determine how and where to start? Assuming the current is too strong to wade, you start with the center of the current, or do you work the boulders and pools along the edges? What flies would you tend to start with? Nymphs, dreamers, etc. So he's talking about some heavy water, which sounds like you have in a few parts of the river there. What are your suggestions to Kevin?
Well, to Kevin, I'd say, you know, for the most part, if you think of trout in the same terms, I guess, that you would humans, is they don't want to work very hard for their food. If there's a lot of food, they'll be out in fairly heavy current to eat it. It's worth their while for the amount of energy that they expend eating that food versus the amount of energy that comes back to them for the size of food that they're getting. So for the most part, they're going to be laying along the edges of that heavy current, not in that heavy current. So I always think that in most trout streams, you're best off thinking of edges, places where they don't have to work that hard to be laying there, but where they could easily go out into the current to grab the food that might be coming down through the current.
So look for those.
That kind of explains it.
Yeah, look for those softer spots and stay out of that big heavy water. And
exactly.
The
fish don't like it out there that much.
Looks like you got a hello here from Kaplan, Louisiana. Tim, Rick and Linda. Say hello. Enjoying the show.
Hello to Linda and Rick. Absolutely.
Okay, always nice to have friends listening in. But we need to
take a
quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk with Tim more about catching those big trout in the frying pan. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Heng about fly fishing the Frying Pan River. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, people have good about sending things in here tonight. We'll see if we've got any more. Okay, here's a question. Rod Brashears in Amarillo, Texas. What about streamer patterns? And I think we also had another question about that in our question. Somebody else had asked about that. Do you use many streamer patterns in the frying pan?
You know, we don't use as many streamer patterns as you might normally on a lot of rivers. And the reason for that is because there's not a lot of bait fish in the frying pan. You know, we have a few sculpins, but we don't really have as many bait fish as we do on, say, the bigger rivers like the Roaring Fork and the Colorado. It's more of an insect factory than it is a small bait fish. But that being said, there's times when you can do very well with streamers up there. Most folks don't fish them an awful lot, but generally, if I'm going to fish them, I'm going to fish them in the fall. It's oftentimes a great time when the brown trout are territorial and getting ready to spawn. Or in low light conditions, if there's been a thunderstorm or heavy clouds, or very early in the morning or very late in the evening are times we'll fish streamers. And we'll fish, you know, mostly basic type of streamers like woolly buggers and maybe some clouds or minnows, that type of thing. But we don't fish as many streamers as we do trying to match the insects that are in the river as much.
Okay, okay. We've got a question here, and this can kind of relate because I know a lot of people will fish that upper 2 miles of water where there are some large fish. And Tim in Menominee, Michigan, would like to know if you could compare the feeding habits of smaller fish and larger fish. You know, do they change? And I think what he's driving at here is, how do you get to and find those larger fish?
Well, the feeding habits, you know, certainly when the bugs are coming off heavily or just normally, the little fish probably eat the same types of bugs that the big fish eat. The fact of it is that the big fish will eat the little fish at times. But what I would tell you is probably the thing that I do more than anything is just look in the river to find those bigger fish. There's certainly times of the year when the larger fish are out and about. One of them is in the fall when the brown trout, late fall, which in the frying pan river, because the water temperature is so cold, our spawning times of the year are a little bit different than in our other rivers in the area, and that we'll see spawning brown trout in December, and we'll still see some spawning brown trout all the way into February. So they'll spawn throughout the winter up in there, and they'll become, you'll start to, they just become more visible just because they're out and about. The same is true of the rainbows. When the rainbow trout are spawning, is oftentimes a little bit later than normal. It will generally happen in late March or April on into June. And again, they've kind of got the spawning urge. They're not hiding as much as at other times of the year. And so you'll see more of those large fish at that times of the year. And it's just, as much as anything, it's just a matter of watching. You have great polarized glasses, wading along the stream. Because it's such a small stream, you can see into it fairly easy in most of its areas, and you can spot some of those bigger fish.
It takes a lot of time, doesn't it, to hunt them down? You know, we were talking with Landon Mayer on a show not too long ago last year, and he's out for big fish all the time. And he told me he would walk for a mile, 2 miles, not even wetting his line, just looking to find that fish. And then he put everything into the presentation on that one fish to get that fish. But that's what it takes really to get big fish, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And certainly Landon knows as well as anybody that, but it's not being impatient especially when you first get to the trout stream. That's the critical time is to make sure you're looking, you're watching. Always your first cast into a pool or an area is always going to be your best one. Any subsequent casts after that, the fish are going to be a little bit more wary, a little bit more aware that that their little world is being invaded a little bit by somebody.
But some of us don't get to fish as much as you do, Tim, and we get really excited when we get up there.
I got to tell you, Roger, I get really
level
excited, too.
Yeah, the patience level has long been used up.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that either.
Well, Tim also asked about the bigger fish. Are they feeding, do they come to the surface, or are they strictly nymph, minnow, crawfish eaters? I don't know if you have any crawfish up there. But.
No, we really don't have any crawfish. And certainly the bigger fish in the frying pan, you know, a lot of them are the mysis shrimp eaters. The very largest fish are the mysis shrimp eaters. But let me briefly just kind of tell you about that. Many years ago,
kind of unique to our area too.
That's right. Many years ago, the Division of Wildlife stocked mysis shrimp into Rudai Reservoir, as well as a few other western reservoirs, as a food source for the Kokanee salmon. Well, it didn't really work out the way they had hoped, but the rivers below where these mysis shrimp were stocked would see mysis being sucked out and into the river below. Because of the different concentrations of oxygen, to be very brief, the mysis shrimp can't live in the rivers. They can only live in the lake. But when they get washed out below the reservoirs, they're a tremendous source of protein. I had a Division of Wildlife officer tell me, a biologist tell me many years ago, that when the shrimp are coming out extremely heavy, that the fish could put on as much as 3 pounds in a month.
Oh, my God.
Now, certainly they couldn't do that for very long. They couldn't do it for 3 or 4 months at a time in a row. But that's how much, if they're coming out really heavy, that these fish can put on the weight. There's no way to tell when they're going to come out. They generally will come out in better numbers when the rivers are higher. Just a higher flow generally has more shrimp coming out. But you can't say at 2 o'clock they're going to be coming out better than they do at 8 or anything like that. There's really not a lot of rhyme or reason why they're coming out. So, and that's, like I said, that's what puts the weight on those fish up by the dam. Usually it's only, in most cases, is only effective in the first mile below the dam. And then those shrimp either get eaten or they die.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do they come out alive out of the dam? And it sounds like they do then.
Yep, they do. They come out alive. They come out wiggling. You can watch them as they're coming down. They're wiggling, but they die shortly thereafter.
Now, do you treat that mysis shrimp as a hatch, so to speak? I mean, do the trout get selective around those, or can you fish those anytime?
Well, you can fish them anytime. Certainly, they're going to be fished or most effective when there's large numbers of them coming out. And when there's large numbers coming out, the fish can get extremely selective on them. And you can see them in the water. You can literally be up there fishing, and you can look down in the water, and you can see these very translucent shrimp that can be as much as 3/4 of an inch in length floating down, and the fish behavior becomes very apparent when that happens, because they are, you know, they're like a bird dog on point. They are excited.
So that's an opportunity for some larger fish, is when the shrimp are on and you're up close to the dam. How close can you get to the dam? Is there restrictions like at other dams because of security reasons and so forth?
No, there really hasn't been. You can fish up fairly, you know, literally right where the water comes out of the dam.
Oh,
in fact,
okay.
That's one of the very, the plunge pool or also nicknamed the toilet bowl, is right where the water comes out of the dam. It's a huge, very deep pool, and that probably has a lot of the very large fish in it, that pool.
Okay. that probably difficult to fish, though, I suppose.
Well, it can be difficult at times, but at times it can be pretty darn good.
Okay. Well, I meant the nature of the water there. Is it strange current, or is it a normal current, or?
It depends on the water flow coming out of the dam, the amount of, okay. of water that's coming out. There's always fish in there that you can see. I mean, you can see good numbers of fish. And sometimes it's easier with the flow of, say, 100 to 200 cubic feet a second. It's much easier to fish than it is at from 200 to 300 or whatever.
So most of the larger fish and also the heavier fished water is that 2 miles below the dam, you'd say, right? Or 1 mile or?
No, it's 2 miles. There's 2 miles of public water right below the dam. Yes, that's definitely the most heavily fished stretch of river.
Okay. Question again from Tim in Menominee, Michigan. He wants to know, when there's not a hatch going on, is there a specific, and I think it's a rather good question, specific sequence of nymph patterns that you try while you're waiting for a hatch to occur?
Absolutely. And it depends on the time of the year again. You know, in the early winter, you know, when we're waiting for the midge hatches, then we're fishing midge larva patterns and midge emerger patterns. When the blue wing olives are coming off in early spring to mid-spring, then we're fishing little blue-wing olive nymphs and blue-wing olive emergers. And then middle of the summer when the great hatches happen, the drakes and stuff, again, the drake nymphs, caddis nymphs, pale morning dun nymphs, it all pretty much corresponds with the time of year and the bugs that we expect to be seeing.
So just look at the hatch that you're waiting for and then kind of backtrack and say, well, what are they doing? While you're waiting, they're down there doing their thing, trying to get up to make the hatch. So you duplicate whatever that stage is of their lifespan.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Do you have any other specific tactics or strategies that you use on the frying pan that maybe a bit different or?
Well, I think
approach
that,
is a little
you know,
bit different.
I think it's critical. You know, we fish. We fish a lot of fluorocarbon tippets up there. Fluorocarbon basically is more of an invisible material, tippet material, to the fish, and we really believe in its effectiveness of up there on being such a hard fished river. Oftentimes, if you can fish downstream to a fish, we try to spot the fish before we cast to it. Some folks don't like to use strike indicators up there because they feel that they will spook the fish, and they may to some degree. If you can see the fish, you don't really need a strike indicator because you can watch the fish. You can watch approximately where your fly is at when it's coming down to him, and you can see whether he turns and opens his mouth or whatever to eat the fly. But I'm a firm believer in strike indicators if you're just trying to cover the water and you're not necessarily seeing the fish that you're trying to catch, just simply because the takes are so subtle. And the ability to react to those takes as quickly as possible is a huge key to your success.
When you say you're using fluorocarbon, I'm assuming that's mainly for the nymphing aspect. How small do you go with that?
You know, in the wintertime when I'm fishing those really tiny midges and things like that, I'll even go down to 8X fluorocarbon.
Wow.
Some of the strength of the tippet materials that we have today are so much better than even 5 or 10 years ago that you can land some pretty significant size fish with some pretty light tippets, especially if you're using a softer rod.
Now, what about fluorocarbon for dry flies? A lot of people don't use that for dry. They say it's too stiff. Do you find that, or do you not use it for dry?
Well, you know, I kind of use it for everything, actually. And I'll tell you why. And the reason why most folks don't like to use fluorocarbon for dry flies is because it has a specific gravity of less than water. So, I mean, so it sinks.
So it's dragging your fly down.
So it's dragging your fly down. Well, in the very small sizes that we use it in, which is oftentimes 6 or 7X, it's not so dense that it really does drag your fly down. And if you feel like it does, then what we'll do oftentimes is we'll just grease our tippet a little bit to within about 4 or 5 inches of our fly. So the rest of your tippet is floating, but yet that 4 or 5 inches that's closest to your fly that the fish notices the most is still sinking and is invisible to them.
Great. Good tip. Brian Whiting in Glenwood, just down the road from you, also wanted to know about, he says, an update about whirling disease in the frying pan. I take it there was a problem there at one time? Or?
There is, certainly, and I think there's, you know, over much of the West, there's been some problems with whirling disease, and the frying pan was no different. And actually, what's happening now is the state of Colorado is experimenting with a new strain of rainbow that's called the Hofer strain, which is came from Germany. That is a rainbow that has proven to be whirling disease resistant. And what they're doing is they're mixing that Hofer strain of rainbow with some different local strains. They'll mix it with a Colorado River rainbow or actually some fish that they just put in the frying pan this past summer was a Harrison strain of rainbow. So it's a Hofer Harrison strain. And they're hoping to see how successful that is. It's proven to be very successful over on the Gunnison River, where they've been experimenting with it for a longer period of time. It's kind of a new deal that's going on, and we're kind of excited to see where it leads to.
It still sounds like it's a challenge to the fish people as far as trying to eliminate it and deal with it.
Probably always will be.
Yeah. One other question we had, and then we kind of have to close things up. A question from the UK, John in the UK. He basically wanted to know about whether it's true or not about, you know, passing scent on to either the water or flies, you know, from your hands, and wondering if you think that is, you know, especially in a river like the frying pan where you've got some, you know, picky and sensitive trout, do you think that's an issue or plays a role at all?
Yeah, I haven't, Roger, really seen that. I think that in some lakes, it certainly could possibly be a factor. I think that in most of our streams here, that most of the fish are feeding on sight versus smell. Some areas, like I said, in a lake or something, smell may be more of a factor, but because it's mostly sight fishing, you know, we're certainly not, you know, going out and washing our hands in gasoline before we tie on our fly or something
right.
like that. But, you know, we don't notice it being a huge factor.
And they probably don't have a whole heck of a lot of time to be smelling it when it's moving downriver, like, as opposed to a lake, like you said, too.
Exactly. And if they are smelling it, then they're also getting a very long time to look at it. And then, you know, our imitations ought to have little motors in them because they're going to be really tough to fool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Tim, we've got to wrap things up here. Time goes by quick, as it always does. But stick with us, folks, here. When we return, we're going to be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And Tim's giving away from Taylor Creek Fly Shop a dozen flies in a Taylor Creek fly box. So stay tuned to see if you win. Are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in Southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit could generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay areas may be at stake. If you're not already acquainted yourself with the concerns, do so now. You can make a difference and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com. And get involved. Be proactive. The battle's not over. They recently voted this down up there in the elections in Alaska and need to help the folks out there. They say they're still going to battle this mine. So get involved and help out where you can. The folks of Alaska and all of us that fish Alaska would really appreciate your help. Well, just a quick reminder to everybody, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage right in Tim's section there that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments. We sure appreciate it. We read all the comments that come in and post them later when the recording's up. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late. Make sure you do so for our next show because you don't want to miss out on possibly winning one of these great prizes. So the first prize we're going to give away is a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to learn more about the FFF, a great organization, it's fedflyfishers.org. www.fedflyfishers.org. So a 3-year membership to that. We're going to pick the winner here, randomly selected from our database. And we have Guy Nestier. I know I pronounced his name wrong. Nestier in Alberta, Canada. So Guy, congratulations on winning that 3-year membership. And we'll be contacting you by email to find out about the details so that we can get that off to you. Now we'll give away a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine at www.flyfusionmag.com. This is a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and the person that's going to enjoy it is going to be James Clairbout. James Clairbout in Colorado. So congratulations, James, on winning that 1-year subscription. So again, we'll contact you after the show and get your personal information. Okay, so we have our final gift to give away, courtesy of Tim Eng and the Taylor Creek Fly Shop. And this one you're going to have to work for. So you have to go to our homepage, find that text box, put in your answer to the question there, and also put in your name and location. And the first person that submits the correct answer will be given this dozen flies in a Taylor Creek fly box. So, okay, here's the question. One of the popular hatches on the frying pan involves a rather large mayfly up to size 12. What is that mayfly? What is that mayfly? We're checking here, Tim. See if anybody.
Well, you gave him a tough one, Roger.
Oh, that's not very tough.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't think so, but sometimes. Yeah, nobody's answering it. I guess nobody was listening. We got Tyler, and he says, Tyler in California, he says drake. Is he correct?
He is correct. I think it's a green drake, but a drake is certainly close enough to win the prize, I think.
Okay, you're the decider. I guess that maybe that was not an appropriate term to use, but considering the political environment these days. But anyway, so Tyler's our winner, right? Great, Tyler. Tyler asked some questions tonight, so pays to stay in there and pay attention. Tyler, send me your email address either via the text box that you just used, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And then I'll communicate with you, and we'll get your info so that Tim can send you those flies. And then you'll have to come out here to Colorado and give them a try. So enjoy, and congratulations. Well, Tim, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. And thanks for sharing your knowledge and expertise about the frying pan.
That's been my pleasure, Roger. And sorry about the phone problems we had a little bit earlier, but hopefully everybody was able to at least listen to most of it.
Yeah, no, I think they did okay, and we got it straight. The cell phone seemed to work fine, so we're good.
Good.
Well, thanks again, and we'll probably see you down here at the fly shows this winter, and we'll hook up again then.
That sounds great, Roger.
Okay, folks, our next broadcast will be on September 17th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show, we're going to interview Robert Tomes, and our topic for the show will be Muskie on the Fly. Muskie on the Fly? You've got to be kidding, right? Well, Robert Tomes isn't kidding at all. In fact, you're going to learn exactly how to hook up with one of these aggressive predators in the next show. Robert's going to demystify the muskie, and he'll tell you why fly fishing for muskie might even be a better option than throwing big plugs at them. So, join us then. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Pier Marquette River Lodge, and Power Fibers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company might benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2. That's 888-961-1115 extension 2. We'd be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.